I don't think you can truly understand Bitcoin until you've mined. So if you've never mined, go get something cheap like a BitAx. Go start mining, and a whole new world is going to be open to you once you realize how mining works.
I think there's a future where everyone's homes are heated by Bitcoin miners, because why not? Otherwise, you're just throwing money away versus at least offsetting some of that cost by earning Bitcoin.
The last thing that I want from as a Bitcoiner is from Daddy Trump to tell everybody which coin to use.
Gun to my head, China or US, I would say I want people to adopt Bitcoin. That's my answer. Hey there, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Adam Semeca. Adam's doing some really cool stuff in Bitcoin. He's got a space heater miner basically set up that he talks about. He's working on and is in beta with a wallet that is just going to be an easy to use Bitcoin wallet. And one of those tools that you'll be able to introduce to your friends and family who don't understand the underlying technology. Very cool stuff. We also get into a little bit of a heated discussion, not heated, just a little bit of a banter at the end on the strategic reserve. In our opinions, we agree on some things, disagree on some things, but it was a lot of fun. Adam's an awesome guy. Really think you'll enjoy this episode. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Adam here with me. Adam, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's good to be here.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to this. So I think we got connected because I saw that someone had said you should be on more podcasts, and you said, "Oh yeah, I'd love to. Maybe I need to." I said, "Hey, let's do it." And you're working on some cool stuff. I'm going to start though in a place that with a very broad, open-ended question that I don't usually begin with, just because a lot of crazy things going on, big announcements, price dips in spite of big announcements. What is your overall feeling and sentiment right now as a Bitcoiner? And tell me why that's where you're at.
Well, personally, I feel a little bit, I don't want to necessarily scare anybody, but I feel a little bit on edge just because there's so many different moving parts geopolitically, you know, in terms of, I live in the United States, and in the US, you know, things are kind of up in the air, so to speak, because there's a lot of, you know, potential promises out there right now. And a lot of people are looking at the Trump administration, trying to see what they're going to do. Are they going to follow through on all these promises and what the extent of those promises are? And a lot of them could potentially have a very serious impact on Bitcoin, not necessarily the protocol, because that's, you know, set in stone, but a lot of the network effects, most certainly the price of Bitcoin, how I'm treated living in the United States as a Bitcoiner. I think that's a big one. And so I think over the next, you know, few months, we're going to start to see a little bit more clarity. You know, we've come out of a period of time where, you know, I don't want to use this too harshly, but, you know, to some degree, Bitcoin and crypto-minded people have been persecuted to some degree. In terms of from, you know, the previous administration cracking down on Operation Checkpoint 2.0 and things like that. Some of that I don't necessarily think was all too bad, because I think that, you know, so some of the projects out there were rightfully prosecuted, you know, some of the legitimate scams. But I'm generally for deregulation as a whole. And I am hoping to see more of that in the coming months, you know, just letting people do what they want. I think that, you know, the water will eventually find a level. I like, you know, I think that if you're in this for the right reasons, you know, you don't want the establishment essentially picking sides. You just want us to leave this alone. So that's kind of where I stand. General sentiment is kind of in between. Just because I think a lot of things could change in the near future. You know, I'm near term really bullish. I'm optimistic. I think that also comes with some degree of concern, because I think there's a legitimate chance that things get really crazy really fast. And I've seen other people talk about this lately. But if the administration really does start actively and aggressively pursuing something like a strategic reserve for Bitcoin, that could really set the spark off for nation state adoption and essentially a geopolitical arms race for a Bitcoin reserve.
Interesting. So, yeah.
That's kind of where I am. I'm in between. Things I think are going to get crazy, but I know, you know, I'm not worried about anything. I know Bitcoin's going to tick tock next block. It's always going to work, but I'm more concerned of like the, you know, everybody, you know, freaking out and blowing up my phone. And we go through these cycles and a lot of people that are new don't necessarily know how to react to some of this stuff. And so it's just going to be an interesting ride, I think, for the next few months.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. I Michelle Weekly, I had her on the podcast a few months ago, and she talked about working in her company, Pi Federal. They have a few different products, but like one of the things is Bitcoin ATMs. And I don't think until I talked to her, I appreciated what like ChoPoint 2.0 meant for people trying to operate in the space. Cause like for us, we're like the Bitcoin way, we provide training for people. We help them take Bitcoin into proper self-custody. We're not touching their Bitcoin, no KYC requirements, like none of that stuff. And so we're able to just TikTok next block, doesn't really matter. And for people who are trying to build sort of in other areas, my takeaway from my conversation with Michelle was that stuff was very materially damaging and frustrating, and the headache and the legal costs and everything that went into it are very much legitimate. So I sort of knew it was going on, but didn't probably appreciate what the impact was on the industry. You know, and unfortunately, like for us, we just don't care what the government's doing. And so there's no sense of unease for us because of our line of business. But I can understand people who are trying to kind of come up with these other components, or, you know, certainly like anyone doing anything custodial is very interested in all of that. And it's going to be interesting to see where the chips fall on this and how serious they are. You know, I've got sort of a contrarian take on the Bitcoin reserve, but it will certainly be impactful. Especially if like the Bitcoin Act is passed, what signal that sends, I think, to many, many other people. Is there, so you said you're on edge. Is there on edge, but not worried? Is it just more a sense of anticipation? Like you're just going to kind of breathe a sigh of relief once we kind of have some clarity as to the direction we're headed? Is that,
I think, maybe that's a way to say it. Yeah. So I like to build Bitcoin products and stuff for people. And as a developer, so to speak, you know, there's a lot of potential precedent being set right now over the last few months and into the future. And you mentioned, you know, one of the things being custody, but also, you know, with the Samurai case and the Tornado Cash case, these are things that impact people writing code. So essentially, you know, there is an opportunity for, you know, somebody who wrote some open source code to be prosecuted for crimes that, in my opinion, probably don't necessarily apply. And if applied broadly, could affect, you know, developers all over the Bitcoin space, you know, honest, unbiased, you know, open source, freedom loving people. Writing code, which in my opinion is protected by the First Amendment under free speech. But that's a big part of it. And you know, one of the things that I'm working on is a Bitcoin wallet. And if, you know, these Tornado Cash and Samurai people are treated unfairly in our court system, it could have serious downstream effects on folks like me. You've already seen a lot of wallets just bail, just leave the US. Wallet of Satoshi, Phoenix wallet, some of the wallets have even gone, you know, just kind of closed up shop. Mutiny basically went under. And I think a lot of that is because of the previous administration's stance on some of these things. And I'm really hoping that when these court cases settle out, they end on a positive note, because if they don't, it's not going to provide a conducive environment for builders in the United States to propagate Bitcoin development. So yeah. That's kind of where my, I guess, little bit of worry or concern is from the developer side. Like I said, though, Bitcoin's still going to work as an open source protocol, as a user, you know, an individual, you're always going to be able to tap into the Bitcoin network. You'll never be able to be stopped. No government, you know, nobody can stop you from sending a Bitcoin transaction. So that's a positive thing. But the tools you're going to be able to have access to are going to be significantly limited. They already are. There are already tools that, you know, I'd love to use as a Bitcoiner in the US that I just can't. And even in certain parts of the US, like New York, you know, they have even, you know, less availability to some of these tools.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I can understand in the space that you're operating within Bitcoin, you know, wanting to have that certainty as to, you know, what level of scrutiny are you going to be under? I didn't start with your background because I wanted to just start with sort of a, you know, get like for you to put your finger on the pulse of Bitcoin, give me your thoughts. Why don't you just sort of tell people who you are? What is your background? How'd you start working on these projects? And then we can jump into what specifically you're doing, because I think it's fascinating.
Sure. I'll kind of run through it real fast. If you don't know me, I started, I found this concept called proof of work in 2017. Unfortunately, it was through a project called Ethereum. So I heard about Ethereum before I ever heard about Bitcoin, but it was really the proof of work that grabbed me. And I read my first article on the concept of proof of work and what it was. And it just blew my mind. And within just a few hours, I had conceived of this idea that I wanted to build, you know, proof of work mining devices for people and make things really easy for them. Because I thought, you know, I want to mine. And I think being able to provide something to make mining easier for other people too would be really fun. That started out as just a concept or idea while I was deployed in the military. And so I was kind of stuck overseas for a while. But when I eventually did come back home, I decided I wanted to get into mining. By this point, I had figured out what Bitcoin was, thankfully. And so I bought my first Bitcoin miner. I think I may have bought a few or a couple, but I shipped them over from China, plugged them in, and was like, now what? So I realized I didn't do enough research. I went back to the drawing board, and this was before there was really a lot of, guides and not a whole lot of people were out there talking about it. Just a few people would have information on mining. It wasn't as popular as it is now. Now there's a lot of really good resources out there. But back then, you know, there really wasn't much. So I just did as much research as I could. I finally fumbled my way through it and got everything set up. And I started having a lot of fun mining. And back then it was a lot more profitable than it is now. I was thinking, man, this is fun. I still want to figure out how to get other people to do this. And I remember having a thought like, man, I wish my mom could do this. Like, there's just no way my mom would ever or could ever mine Bitcoin. It's just way too complicated. And so that was kind of my motivator, to build what eventually came, the BitKit is what we called it. And by the way, we named this in 2018, if anybody's curious. We came out with this in 2018, the BitKit, and it was basically, it's just a, actually, in fact, I have one. Let me see if I can look it up. I have one out here. It's running right now, by the way.
That's awesome.
It's my personal heater in my office. But we made this box. It's just a computer, essentially filled with ASICs, and you plug it in and turn it on, and it starts mining Bitcoin. It's 100% plug and play, and we were the first to develop a truly plug and play at home ASIC miner. So we started selling those in 2018, and the business is still running today. That's where I started. And then kind of recent history, a few months ago, I started a project called Mana. It's an open source wallet. It is a, you know, same approach. It's intended to be, you know, plug and play, easy for everybody to use. And that is in the kind of final days of private beta. So it's getting very close to being launched to the public.
Very cool. So do you have a technical background? Like, are you a developer, or do you have friends, people in your life who have helped you with any of that?
No, I'm just crazy. Like, awesome. I don't know. I see something that I want to do, and I just don't stop until I figure out how to do it. That's kind of been my perspective, or until I, you know, have enough of it. until it beats me. But usually that doesn't happen, because once I get determined enough to like convince myself that something needs to exist, I just, you know, hit the hammer as hard as I can, as long as I can, until it actually comes out.
Yeah. So let's talk about the big hit for a little bit. So I love the idea. I mean, we're talking a lot more at the Bitcoin Way about solo mining, you know, adding decentralization to the network. I think the fact that it's your office heater, to me, I think there's a future where everyone's homes are heated by Bitcoin miners, because why not? Otherwise, you're just throwing money away versus at least offsetting some of that cost by earning Bitcoin. I think swimming pools and saunas, hot tubs, like all these things, someday, like, there's going to be an integration kit for a lot of these things to be heated with a Bitcoin miner. And I'm curious, like, in terms of the design of your miner, you said it's plug and play. You have to plug in a wallet where any earnings would go to. How about, like, can you point or does it default to mine with a certain pool? Is it just, are you playing the lottery and it's 100% solo mining? How does that work?
No, it's all managed internally. And so that, you know, speaking to a Bitcoin focused audience, like, that's typically viewed from, you know, if you're a technical person, like, you typically don't necessarily want that, but it's really good for, you know, somebody that doesn't have any idea or desire to learn more about how to take more control of their own sovereignty. So it's not necessarily as, you know, sovereign as something like a solo miner. Like, you can, for example, you can get like a Bitax, point it to your own pool. It's just, it requires a lot more steps. So in order to make it as easy as we did, we abstract all those steps out. And literally all you do is you plug this thing into the wall, you turn on your account, like, you go onto the website, you just put your email address in, and then you scan a code on the back of the miner. That's literally it. There's no other configuration, nothing at all. When you start mining, the balance gets deposited into your account on the website. And then when you're ready to make a withdrawal, you can send it to any Bitcoin wallet. But as far as configuration goes, it's extremely minimal.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes sense. So for the example you used of, like, I want my mom to be able to plug this thing in and set it up. So is it mining then by default to a pool, or?
Yes. Yeah, that's pre-configured on our end. So the user doesn't have any say over what pool is used.
Okay. Okay. What, do you mind if I ask what pool it is?
We actually have a few. We have a primary pool, which we don't necessarily disclose. If you want to find out what that is, if you're technical enough, you can figure it out. But the reason why we don't disclose it is because of our reward system. The way that it's calculated, we just try to limit the amount of information out there so that it doesn't become gamified, because, you know, there is potential for somebody to abuse the system. So we do say it is not a Chinese pool. And we do say that it is not one of, you know, the top three pools, and that's intentional. We want to make sure that the hash rate is as distributed as possible. So, the other thing is we use Stratum V2, which is a kind of a nice, protocol used in mining that helps, strengthen the network, makes things a little bit more secure and safe for the miner. Aside from that, we don't specifically specify which pool is our primary pool and which ones are secondary and tertiary.
Yeah. I like that. Philosophically, I'm a little more cypherpunk and want control and, you know, get to either point to the pool of my choice or, to just straight solo mine. But, I think that there are a lot of people, especially as we progress into this like early majority, I think we're in the very, very beginning stage of like an early majority adoption of Bitcoin. People who this conversation would already be over their heads, and we haven't even dug into the weeds much. And I would rather have people mining Bitcoin and doing this, even if they don't understand everything going on. And I think the fact that you're not pointing to a pool in China or one of the big three is a step in the right direction. So, I love it. How much, I can't hear it in the background. Does it make much noise? Like how many chips do you have in that?
There is two, S9s in there.
Okay. Two S9s.
We use a custom, basically just custom profile, tuning profile. It took us many years to be able to figure out the right balance of power, energy, and, you know, sound and heat. It's a very, it's a dance. It's a technical balance. But, you know, after lots and lots of trial and error, we came up with a product that gives you, or at least gave you, comparatively speaking, historically speaking, a decent hash rate with low decibel volume level. And obviously the heat is going to be remain constant. So it's just whatever wattage you're pulling in.
So with the S9s, did you literally pull the boards out and just build your shell around that? Or did you like take the chips off and like reconfigure to like make it fit a certain mold?
No, actually, if you open up the case, you'll see two complete S9s.
Cool. Yeah, because I imagine that also makes setup a lot simpler, helps you keep the time to turn it around a lot. Because I know like we had Scott from BitAx on a few weeks ago. And I mean, like the BitAx that most people see is a single ASIC chip in there. And they've got to like take that ASIC chip off of a board and put it in onto there. And so it's a very, it's a labor of love. And it's part of what I love about them. But I think in terms of, you know, mass production, we talk about this early majority getting into it. Something like this is probably going to scale a bit more readily. And I imagine a lot more S9s are coming off the market. Because they can't compete as effectively like at industrial scale. So probably makes the supply chain a bit simpler for you to work with.
Yeah, and that's another thing. And you kind of hit on this a little bit earlier in terms of, being able to configure things a little bit more. I've probably sold more BitAxes than I've sold of my own product over the years. And especially to the audience that would be, you know, watching this interview, most of the time, you know, my product's not a good fit. Like if you are somebody that's, you know, that can take control and you can put a few, you know, you can do a little bit of configuration, it makes a lot more sense to get something like a BitAx. And so, you know, more often than not, I'm telling people not to buy my product just because a lot of people come, to buy one. And I'm sure many people in the industry can attest to this, but a lot of people don't really understand the intricacies of the cost benefit analysis of mining. And so I get a lot of new people, you know, that's part of what we are. You know, we attract a lot of no coiners and they're interested in mining and they want to like put their life savings into mining because they think they're going to get rich. And so it's a hard conversation to tell somebody, you know, that they're going to have to spend, you know, our products we sell for, you know, they're over $3,000. And when we first launched these, the difficulty was so much lower. You know, it was more of a product of utility when we first started building these because, you know, your ROI was, you know, maybe within, you know, a year or so, like, our early customers, you'd buy the product and then within a year or so you'd pay it off. And then everything after that was profit. They've kind of bridged kind of over into what I would consider more novelty territory now. And so, you know, I'm not pushing these nearly as hard as I was before, just because, you know, I'm really careful to not, I don't want people to get the product thinking that it's going to be practical. And I'll be the first to admit, like, the product that we sell and offer at Hands Free Bitcoin, it is not, from a utility perspective, it's not practical. You're probably never going to get your ROI back. And this is a conversation that I had with my customers. Like, if this is something you still want to do and you just want to mine to mine and you want to have fun and you want to use it as a good educational tool, or maybe, you know, you want to buy it as some kind of a vanity product or whatever, like, go for it. But if you want to actually try to make some money, you know, if ROI is your main goal, or this is the way I put it normally, I say, if your goal is to acquire the most amount of sats possible, just trade your fiat and go get some sats. That's typically my recommendation. And then when you're ready, go find a miner that is going to give you that educational component as well and help you support the network. But don't get into mining with the idea that you're going to get rich, because a lot of people come for that and everybody's disappointed.
Yeah. So could you see yourself then? I mean, well, first of all, do you agree with my thesis that there's going to come a day where you know, instead of HVAC, technicians working on traditional home heaters, that Bitcoin miners are going to be plugged in. And I'm not suggesting that's 2 years from now, or I don't really know what the timeline is. We'll see. Maybe some of the first things we talked about, we'll see what the arms race looks like to accumulate Bitcoin and what that means for mainstream adoption. But could you see yourself, if you agree with that, or maybe even just generally agree with the premise, migrating from just like a box that may heat your room, which I think will still have utility because people have space heaters, into more, commercial grade, like utility driven miners for, you know, heating your home, like your whole home, not sitting as a space heater, heating your swimming pool, those sorts of things. Like, is that something you would anticipate?
I think that will continue to grow. I have a different opinion on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the opinion? I'm curious.
So a lot of people, you know, in Bitcoin, may not want to hear the more practical side of things, but I try to take a, you know, more of a rational approach on everything, just objectively as much as I can. I do think that, like you said, I think that'll continue to grow. I don't think that it's going to be commonplace in the sense that, you know, when you go buy a home in 5 years, it's going to have the HVAC system tied into a Bitcoin miner. And the only reason why I say that is because I don't think the cost benefit is going to be there for most people. The cost to install a miner that is going to have you, that is going to get you any amount of hash rate that's going to be considerable, you know, even in 5 years, if you just look at the growth rate of the difficulty, it's really difficult, no pun intended, to be profitable with Bitcoin mining. And when I'm saying profitable, I'm not just referring to the amount of electricity you pay to the amount of Bitcoin you generate. I'm talking about hardware cost, installation cost. So your ROI for most people, I think, is still going to be negative. So there are some cases where I do think that it is objectively a good idea for people to mine Bitcoin, for profit. That is, you know, if you're cost and profit focused, it is a very, very small amount of people, very small. In fact, I'd go as far as to say, if you're watching this right now, you're probably not one of these people. But that is, if you have access to free electricity and it is reliable in the sense that, well, let me give you an example. So some people will say, oh, I got free electricity, I should mine Bitcoin because I rent, you know, a house or an apartment and my landlord gives me, you know, included utilities. Well, once you start mining Bitcoin and your utilities cost more than the profit that they're getting off of you as a tenant, they're either going to kick you out or they're going to take away your free electricity.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very few amount of people that would actually fall into that category to be able to, you know, to do this. But they do exist. They're out there. You know, some people have access to, you know, natural gas generators. Maybe they live on a gas well or something like that, and they already use gas to power everything around their home or their farm or something like that. You know, that may make sense. But again, you're probably not watching this right now because that's very few people. All five of those people should go ahead and do it. But there's another category of people, which is a little bit more broad, and that is, if you need to electric resistively heat something, so if you've got like a space heater and you have to use a space heater, use a Bitcoin miner instead. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, you can get, you know, a cheap-ish Bitcoin miner. It doesn't have to be state of the art, top of the line, but if you're going to be using those watts to use heating, you might as well be making some sats in the process. Again, it is a pretty small group of people because, at least in the United States, generally pretty much everywhere in the U.S., we have access to gas, and it's always a lot cheaper than electricity for heating. So, you know, a BTU per, dollar is going to be cheaper to heat with gas most places in the U.S. So outside of that, I think mining is... It's a novelty. And I don't mean that, you know, in a negative way. Like, I still think people should mine Bitcoin, but don't make it a priority. Like, don't say I need to start mining before I buy my stack, right? Buy your stack first, get your position in, you know, make sure you have that that nest egg of Bitcoin as much as you think you might need. And then when you're ready, go have some fun. Go mine for fun. Go mine for education. And I would also add to that, like, I don't think you can truly understand Bitcoin until you've mined. So if you've never mined, go get something cheap like a BitAx. Go start mining, and a whole new world is going to be open to you once you realize how mining works.
Yeah. I think you're onto something. And to be clear, my projection for that isn't over 5 years, but maybe something like 20. But I still think I could be totally wrong if hardware costs don't come down. If there aren't more producers, we're still reliant on, you know, one or two big manufacturers to produce the ASICs. I guess maybe I would say in principle, I think that future makes a lot of sense under the right conditions. And I don't know what it'll take to get there, but I agree with you that today, even if the whole world woke up to Bitcoin tomorrow morning, I think that with the cost of the hardware you'd need to heat a decent sized home, probably you're not going to be profitable for a long time. The only caveat to that would be if you have a sort of a sufficiently large cohort who understands the importance of contributing to the decentralization of the network, and so they're doing it both for, hey, I'll pay a little bit more for the hardware, earn some sats, ROI could be sooner, could be later, but I'm also adding to this thing that I care about. I don't think that's going to be most of the early majority. I think we're already losing that with a lot of people, with a lot of newer entrants into Bitcoin.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I fall into that category too. You know, I mine at a loss 24/7. I do it just to support the network because it's fun. I think we can probably move on after this, but I want to throw a couple things to add to that before we get off this such a negative conversation. I've been like a Debbie Downer over here.
But
you also have to consider, you know, the cost of capital. So, and I'm not just talking about your own personal cost of capital. I'm talking about the general cost of capital in the economy. So you have these gigantic public miners and even governments and monopolies like utilities companies and energy producers that are mining Bitcoin with a cost of capital that's near zero. So they can essentially borrow an arbitrage fiat from the future and bring it to today. That's going to increase the difficulty and decrease the profitability. And so that's one factor you need to consider. So you're competing against people that can get free money. And the second thing that you need to consider is the difficulty itself is going exponential. So even if you're all, you know, even if you're just considering, you know, hardware cost, like it's not just the cost of the hardware, but it's the ratio or the relationship between the cost of the hardware and the difficulty, right? Because you could get the best state-of-the-art miner right now, and it's going to be really expensive, but by the time you're in, you know, ROI territory, the difficulty could be significantly higher. And there's a lot of conversations of, you know, more governments getting involved, large companies getting involved, in mining, especially with energy producers where they, you know, you think of like, ExxonMobil, you know, they could essentially just flip a switch and, generate a lot of hash power. Let's just put it that way. So anyway, I think it beat that dead horse or not, but
you think that's the next wave though, is companies like Exxon waking up to this? I mean, my sense is that some of the big oil and gas companies are already doing this.
They are.
Yeah. But on what scale though? Like, is this something that's kind of like an experiment for them, or are they like, no, we should be mining Bitcoin?
I can't say for sure. One, because I really don't know. And even if I did, I probably wouldn't be able to spill any beans. But I know 4 years, energy producers have been testing mining. And I know energy producers all over the place have been mining Bitcoin to some scale. I can't tell you what scale that is, but at least in the past, I know they have been mining Bitcoin.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what the next few years bring in the space. The thing for me that, you know, like for like a home heater, I think one of the biggest challenges, and by the way, Adam, this doesn't feel like a downer conversation. I think it's just a practical reality that the best way for most people to acquire SATs is to just trade your fiat. The best way to start learning more about Bitcoin, engaging with the network, or one of the best ways is to mine some Bitcoin, buy a BitAx, buy something like what you've got. If you don't feel technical and you have a reason for a space heater, I think it all makes a lot of sense. As we progress, it's going to be interesting to see, because the other thing that's going to be in tight demand, it would seem like, are technicians qualified to repair miners. And so like if you buy a $200 BitAx or whatever they cost, or even a $3,000 heater, you know, space heater, basically like what you're selling, if it breaks, if your device breaks, maybe there's some desire to fix it. You know, like $3,000 is a significant investment. Your BitAx breaks, you know, you're just going to throw it away and maybe buy a new one. But as more of these come online, and maybe as we enter the mainstream use of these sorts of devices for utility purposes, who's going to fix them when they break? And to me, that feels like it's probably as big of a gap as the hardware costs right now, because there are, like, if I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, if I had an S19 and it broke and I don't know how to fix it, I have no idea who to call and help and have it cost effectively repaired. Maybe there's someone around here, but I don't know that for sure. I've never looked into it. And certainly in, you know, many places with cheaper electricity where they might be able to justify the cost, there's probably no one. And that's something that I think everyone needs to consider too. Do you have any thoughts? Is that something that you think is going to be like taught in trades, not in 5 years, but, you know, in 10, 20 years taught in trade schools, like, hey, here's, you know, ASIC miner repair, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I wish I would have had this question before, because there are some resources I'm aware of. I just can't think of them off the top of my head, but there are essentially trade schools that specify specifically train in ASIC miner repair. So okay. I know they exist. Mining Disrupt, the conference in Florida, they have every year. They have a lot of stuff focused on that. So if you're interested, maybe check out Mining Disrupt. Most of these technicians, they go and they go get hired on by the big, you know, public miners. Sometimes they're private as well, but the big public miners, they always have, you know, these technicians on hand. Some of them will train in house as well too. So, you know, if that's something you're interested in, reach out to, you know, a miner and just ask them, you know, what they recommend. Maybe they have something, you know, like I said, maybe they have something in house, or they could refer you to one of these programs. Yeah, I would agree. Like the demand for these technicians, I think, is going to go up. And I think all you have to see to recognize that is the difficulty, the difficulty rate. You know, look at that chart. That's how in demand these technicians are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully the free market leads us to the right supply of technicians, because I agree. I think we're going to need them in the future. Okay, let's talk about Mana. So this is a more recent project for you. Sounds like, because I was looking for it on the App Store. I was going to play around with it before and didn't see it. So on one hand, there are a lot of wallets people can use. On the other hand, in the United States, several very good ones have left. Is this an on-chain wallet, Lightning, both? And what was the inspiration behind getting into this?
From a 10,000 foot view, this, I think, should be seen as a Lightning wallet. Okay. So
okay.
I would even abstract that further and just say, you know, to the general public, we're just going to be presenting this as a Bitcoin wallet. But for you and for your viewers, you know, I think it's worth understanding, you know, the actual process of how this works under the hood, because it does matter to people like us. But we want to try to build a product. Essentially, one of our goals is to be able to provide a wallet to somebody that they can use where they don't need to know anything about what layer one means. You know, they don't need to know how to do an on-chain transaction or if they're going to use Lightning or Liquid or anything like that. Basically condensed into one unified UI And so all you need to know is basically you put a number in, how much do you want? How much do you want to send or receive? And that's it. So that's kind of our goal as far as the user experience goes. But under the hood, it is compatible with layer one on-chain transactions. Of course, it's compatible with Liquid and compatible with Lightning. All the transactions coming and going out are swapped through Lightning. So every transaction you send or receive is ultimately going to be touching the Lightning network.
Okay. But from a user experience perspective, all they know is I need to send Bitcoin to this address, whether it's Liquid, Lightning, on chain, and it happens. All that stuff takes place under the hood.
Yeah. One of our major priorities is merchant adoption. So we think that there's still a lot of room for people, you know, in the general broad economy that say, hey, I want to start accepting Bitcoin for my business, but I just don't know how. And so we're kind of trying to look at things from that perspective. So when somebody says, hey, I take Bitcoin, you don't have to ask them, well, do you take on-chain transactions? Is it right. Lightning? Is it Liquid? You know, what kind of Bitcoin, what network and protocol do I need to use? You don't need to do any of that. If somebody says, we take Bitcoin, you can use Mana and pay them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's nice. I feel like, you know, again, back to this concept of like where we are in the life cycle of Bitcoin adoption, I think that those sorts of solutions are going to become more important, because if you're not sitting around listening to Bitcoin podcasts all day and reading all the books and staying, you know, catching up with new developments, as far as you're concerned, that Bitcoin is one thing and you can send it or you know, and to have solutions available where you don't have to know. It's sort of like the example of, I was talking to a friend of mine recently, and he was saying, can't get my head around like how Bitcoin really works. And like, he's not going to spend the time to really deep dive on the technology. And I told him, I said, that's okay. Like, you don't know how your refrigerator works either. And it does the trick for you. And it sounds to me like you're kind of building the refrigerator for people that you don't have to have any level of technical sophistication. It just does what you sort of understand Bitcoin to be able to do, and how that's being routed to the end receiver is irrelevant, I guess. Do I have that right?
I think you nailed it. And I'm smirking because you said technical, what was the phrase you used?
Technical sophistication.
Technical sophistication. I'm smirking because I am very empathetic with people that are very technically unsophisticated. So, you know, I come from a position of ignorance myself. You know, I'm not a classically trained developer or coder or engineer. I'm just a guy who wants a product that works. And so it's, you know, kind of first nature for me to look at things from a broad view and think, you know, is this easy enough for a guy as dumb as me to use it? And if the answer is no, we keep working on it. And that's not the only reason, you know, why Mana is why we're here, right? It's not just to make things a little bit easier, but there's, as we kind of talked about, like there's been a little bit of a gap like left by some of the other wallets that have left the United States. So as a United Statesian, you know, I think that there's definitely some room for some more players in the space. It's also really important to know that like what the things that we're setting out to achieve, they're pretty easy to do with a custodial wallet. But we're doing it in a non-custodial fashion, a self-custodial fashion. So when you download Mana, you know, you hold the keys. It's not something that, you know, somebody can ever take from you or censor. So, you know, Mana cannot censor your transactions. We can't rug you. Other custodial wallets that offer some of the similar features, they can, right? Because they hold the keys. But we give our users the keys. And that was really the biggest challenge of accomplishing these things is how do we do it, but also do it in a manner that protects our users. So there's that. And I feel like there's probably, you know, other reasons too, but essentially focusing on the merchant adoption, we just think that there's a huge gap there. There are some really great options. Let me just say, like, just to name drop some, like obviously BTC Pay Server is great, Zaprite. There are a lot of great options on the market that are self-custodial. They're just a little bit more cumbersome. We think that there's a little bit of a gap between a custodial centralized service and a fully sovereign self-custodial option where you have to run your own server, which requires quite a bit more setup, like BTC Pay Server. It's not hard. And if you think you can do it, I would encourage you to do it. It's really not that hard at all. We just think that there's a lot of people in the gap in between there that they could do it, but they just won't. And so that's kind of where we want to live, is being something that's essentially plug and play, where a business can say, you know, let me, I want to take Bitcoin, but I don't want to run my own server. Now, you're still going to run your own server. This is, you know, kind of the punchline, I guess, so to speak, or the spoiler here. Because with Mana, you're still running a server. You just don't know it. It's really easy to set up. It's, you know, it runs on your phone. But you're not even aware that you're setting up a server. You just download an app and it runs a server on the app. And, that's how it reconciles the transactions.
Yeah. That's really cool. It's funny because for us, it's frustrating at times that it is pretty straightforward. I mean, we at the Bitcoin Way, we've trained 80-year-olds to run their own node, self-custody their Bitcoin. And yet there are still a very large percentage of people who, even that friction, regardless of the advantages and the upside, it's too much for them. They're not going to do something. And they're not going to take the step that they really need to take. So I think, yeah, having these sorts of, especially as you think about like merchant adoption and that, I have a feeling there are probably a lot more merchants who would be willing to accept Bitcoin than do, because it seems like this overwhelming thing. And if there was just a simple way, and to your point, there are ways that you can do it that aren't overly cumbersome, but they probably don't fully appreciate that and realize that the more plug and play, click through and get set up, it can be the more likely they'll be to take action and actually do something. So I love these sorts of solutions. Is there anything else you want to say on that, or you want to get into the good stuff?
Let's go.
Okay. So I'm just warning you, Adam, if you're at all like most Bitcoiners, maybe we'll have a little bit of banter here, because there are some things that I think I have some unpopular opinions myself. So the first one, everyone's talking about the strategic reserve. You alluded to it. Would be curious to hear your thoughts on that, if you're excited about that, if you're disappointed. And then we can kind of tie in the Bitcoin Act that's been proposed. And I don't know how likely that is to pass. I'm hearing murmurs that it's becoming increasingly likely to pass and the U.S. is going to buy 1 million Bitcoin. What's your take? And be ready in case we disagree. Maybe we can have a fun little banter here.
There's a lot of nuance in that question.
sure.
I'm just going to give like my personal opinion. I'm not going to say like this is right or this is wrong. I think there's, you know, credible opinions on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. I will concede with saying up front, like the last thing that I want as a Bitcoiner is from Daddy Trump to tell everybody which coin to use, right? Like, I don't think that, you know, the U.S. government saying Bitcoin is cool is going to make anyone think that Bitcoin's cool. So that's kind of where I stand on that from that front. That's like my negative stance. But I am generally, overall, overwhelmingly positive about the United States buying Bitcoin. And it's not because I want more government power. It's because I want my government to be aligned with the same incentives that I have as a Bitcoiner. And I think ultimately Bitcoin, Bitcoin changes you. Bitcoin changes individuals. And I think it has already changed the government. It's already impacted elections. It's already, in my opinion, improved transparency in a lot of different government activities, whether it's the Treasury or what Doge is doing, or even coming down to non-government agencies such as the Federal Reserve. I think are also being kind of held accountable to some degree because of what Bitcoin is doing. I don't necessarily like if you had a ballot in front of me, like if I had to say yes or no, should the U.S. buy Bitcoin? I don't know. I would have a hard time answering that question right now on the spot. It would probably take a lot more concerted effort for me to actually work through that. But it doesn't matter either way, because it's been said before, governments are going to buy Bitcoin. That was always a part of the plan. And there's no stopping. Everybody's going to have to buy Bitcoin. And as Saifedean says, either you adopt gunpowder or somebody else does and they conquer you. And so I would rather be the country that adopts the gunpowder and be the first. I know, you know, it's kind of stepping out on a ledge because it kind of puts a target on us, but it also encourages other people to wake up, you know, and there are other countries out there that aren't necessarily as friendly with the United States, and they're going to be set on notice to make sure that they don't fall behind too. And so I think it, optimistically, that's what this does. And, you know, I would just say, like, if we actually do start going down the path of acquiring 1 million Bitcoin, as you said, like, that's going to make things very crazy, very fast. So, you know, like I said, my opinion, I'm for it. I support and approve of a Bitcoin standard in the United States, just from the simple fact that it aligns my government's incentives with my own. And I know that now, you know, if the United States is serious about the Bitcoin that they hold, and their goal with that Bitcoin is to foster it and to be good stewards of it, and ultimately, from kind of a selfish perspective, like, grow the economy with it, then, you know, I think that just means that it's going to make my life a lot easier for the things that I want to do as a Bitcoiner, and become more self-sovereign myself.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I think that that's one of the more eloquent pro Bitcoin reserve arguments I've heard. And I think we agree on a few things. I mean, I think we both agree that it's not about the government being more powerful. I'm about as anti-state as you can get, I think, at this point. And I don't want my government to be more powerful. I do agree with you. It was inevitable. And so, you know, me screeching about it doesn't really change the fact that eventually this day is coming and governments are going
to
be...
If I can interrupt you real quick.
Yeah.
I don't want to lose that thought. I have a question for you. So just to push back on your end of your opinion, right now, let's just say you had to choose either China buys 1 million Bitcoin or the U.S. buys 1 million Bitcoin. Which would you rather have?
Yeah, I mean, that gun to my head, that's a hard call to make. And part of the reason is because is obviously my interests lie in this country, but my confidence is in the people and the ideals and not in the state. And I think you could make a very compelling argument that China is proactively trying to make friends with people with countries around the world. And the United States government has done a very effective job of making enemies with just about everyone around the world. And so, on one hand, I don't want to be living in the place with less optionality. On the other hand, I'm unconvinced that the United States outcompeting China on Bitcoin necessarily betters the world. And part of it too, and here's the other piece of my argument, is when you think about, like, a strategic reserve, let's say just hypothetically for a minute that all of the gold is in Fort Knox, right? So we've got pretty damn sound money in the United States in massive reserves. Let's just say assume it's all there. That has done nothing to turn off the money printer and to induce any sort of fiscal responsibility. It's done nothing to take away power from people who are removing the purchasing power of the poorest people in our country. And so to me, the notion that having the strategic Bitcoin reserve somehow reins in government doesn't add up. I think as long as the money printer exists, and for me, the goal is end central banking, make Bitcoin money and not use Bitcoin as digital gold. I understand the case for, like, I think digital gold is a, like, you're way underselling what Bitcoin is, but I understand that it's a useful sort of way of getting someone who understands gold into, okay, so it's digital gold, so it has all these other advantages. I understand that. And yeah, I agree with you. It's inevitable, but it's really unclear to me. Gun to my head, China or U.S., I would say I want people to adopt Bitcoin. That's my answer. And so, you know, like, here's the thing, though. That's a very good question and a very good way of framing it. And I've thought about it now for a minute and a half or two. I would need to think about it more. But I think at the end of the day, it's really hard to anticipate what either option leads to, you know, and if it just sits in a digital vault, I don't think it leads to any net productive gain. And I think if, I think we're more likely to have a 6102 style attack from the government if they already have Bitcoin the way that we already had gold reserves back in the 1930s. And I don't know that I have a real good answer to that.
So I really strongly agree with something you said there. And that is, you know, if it just sits in a digital vault, it doesn't, you know, provide any value, right? Essentially, if we just replaced what we've done with gold in the past with Bitcoin, it doesn't fix any problems. And I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
But the other component to that is, you know, if we're holding the gold, and as I said earlier, I prefaced it with saying, you know, if the United States wants to use the Bitcoin to stabilize the economy, essentially make money on their Bitcoin, then they're gonna I think be incentivized to interact with Bitcoin in a way that benefits the value. And so the things that actually improve the value of Bitcoin for its users are, you know, things like being able to exchange with people. It's even privacy aspects of it. It's you know, the uncensorable nature of Bitcoin. And if as soon as you start taking those things away and you just essentially have like a Bitcoin ETF, or you know, have a vault of wrapped Bitcoin or something like that, like you lose all of the value of what makes Bitcoin valuable. And so right. I think the United States or any sovereign country would understand that as soon as they started, you know, doing that and abstracting the value from Bitcoin, their holdings are going to go down too. So in order to make Bitcoin more valuable, the United States or any government is going to try to, you know, have regulation and even, you know, essentially pass or remove laws to make Bitcoin better for the individuals, because that's what makes the price of Bitcoin go up, which if the U.S. is holding Bitcoin, that's what they want, even though they don't necessarily know they're shooting themselves in the foot, you know, with their legacy fiat monetary system, because ultimately Bitcoin's gonna eat their lunch. But my point is, you know, they're gonna be incentivized to make that number go up. And the only way to do that is to make Bitcoin more appealing. They're gonna have, you know, demand has to increase.
I guess my concern is that will demand increase and all the number go up, Maxis, who I'm so tired of hearing about on Twitter. Will they get what they want? They're fabulously wealthy because the U.S. adopted a strategic reserve and buys a million Bitcoin. But there's nothing moves the needle in the direction of using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. Or, like, here's the thing: no one in government necessarily right now, in the current administration, I've heard, is suggesting that Bitcoin shouldn't be used as a medium of exchange or anything like that. But I think it would be easy, especially as newer people enter the market, for this narrative of digital gold to sort of take hold. And people are like, oh yeah, I'll buy the ETF, so that way my dollar value, you know, I'm going to earn a bunch of fiat. Or, oh, I'll buy even spot Bitcoin. I'm going to buy it and maybe self-custody, which is great because it gives you optionality. Or I'll just keep it on the exchange or in some other custodial arrangement. And they just get comfortable with earning more and more dollars. And nothing gets fixed. Like, right. Like I'm here for the peaceful revolution, and the peaceful revolution is a Bitcoin standard, not where governments and people just hold Bitcoin for it to, the only way Bitcoin ends forever wars and ends inflation and ends all of these things that we talk about that we want as Bitcoiners is if Bitcoin is used as money in the marketplace. Because if it's just like if it's just an IOU that you have, or it's just sitting in some government vault, they're going to keep printing dollars to keep funding stupid wars that we don't want to be involved in. And they're going to keep on printing money to cover up the next economic calamity that they've created because of the last bubble that they started producing after 2008 or COVID or whatever. And I feel like that's kind of my concern. Like, the litmus test for me is always, is what it being done pushing Bitcoin to be used as money? And is it pushing for the end of central banking? And if the answer is no to either of those, I'm either disinterested or actively opposed, I guess.
I don't think I could possibly agree with you anymore.
Okay.
I guess it's music to my ears. No, and I've personally said this in other ways many, many times, and that is, you know, you have these advocates that are either intentionally misleading, or maybe they truly believe it, that Bitcoin is maybe either a better store of value than it is a medium of exchange, or it shouldn't be a medium of exchange and it should only be a store of value. And I push back on that every time I see it. And I say store of value does not protect us from a CBDC. And I frame it that way because I think it helps people understand, you know, really what's at stake. Because we're trending toward, as a planet, we're trending toward totalitarian control through CBDCs. The technology is already there. It's being rolled out all over the world. Europe is introducing a CBDC in October. And I would even take that a step further that, like, you know, a lot of us, even listening right now, are using the technology that could very easily be used as a CBDC. If you're using a stable coin, it's pretty easy to flip a switch and turn a stable coin into a CBDC. But my point is, and I'm getting a little bit off on a tangent, but my point is, and as you mentioned, you know, number go up, ETFs, you know, all these, you know, fiat denominated gains, this mentality, it does not save us from central banking. It has to be used as a money, including a medium of exchange. And you can't send it peer-to-peer anywhere in the world at any time without permission from anybody, then you can't defend yourself against a CBDC, and therefore, you know, you can't replace central banking. Yeah, and that's a big part of why I'm building Mana. In fact, one of the things that I often refer to Mana as is an anti-CBDC. So Mana is a way for you to transact with anybody in the world through Bitcoin, and you don't have to rely on anybody else. You know, we don't have any stable coins on our platform. There's no altcoins. There's no fiat at all. It's just Bitcoin. And so, I think you're preaching to the choir here. I'm pretty much as anti-central banking as they come. My argument, though, is that the government buying Bitcoin and having that number go up, even fiat mentality, it provides me cover to build Mana. Like, not just me, but everybody, all the developers like me that are building these tools that make life better and more free for all of us here, for you and I. I don't have to worry about going to jail as much this year as I did last year. You know what I mean? Like, just for writing some code. You know, I'm not even doing anything illegal, but just, you know, somebody using my code and then doing something evil with it, that could send me to jail. And there's people on trial right now for developing code and then somebody did something illegal with it. And so, like I said, I think, you know, I understand, like, you know, I'm not a bootlicker. And I despise anybody who is, but, we can work on that. If that's you, you know, we can have a talk. But my point is, like, we don't need the government, but it's nice to have them on our side because, you know, the enemy of our enemy is our friend. And if the government's going to provide us some cover to end the Fed, I'm for it.
Yeah. I hope it goes that way. I think I tend to, based on historical context and the clues I've picked up, I'm always more optimistic about the rest, anything in the world but government. And so I'll be curious to see what path, especially if strategic reserves already here. If the Bitcoin Act passes, that is that's, you know, gas on the fire of acquisition. Like, it's pretty easy to sign an executive order that creates this thing. And, you know, who knows what they do with it. The Bitcoin Act itself, where it's, no, we're going to actively buy Bitcoin. I guess my other question, of course, is when you're running a $2 trillion deficit, where's that money coming from to buy a million Bitcoin? And it's coming from either higher inflation, because they're going to print to do it, or it's coming from my taxes. And I would rather them let me keep my money that instead of them stealing it so I can buy more Bitcoin. And so there are a lot of things for me that's like, hey, all else equal, okay, fine, maybe, as long as you don't derail the narrative of freedom money. But I'm less optimistic on government doing that. And I'm also completely baffled as to how they're going to fund this without making other people poorer. So that's, yeah, maybe there's some workaround, but politicians don't generally seem to work in the best interest of everyone, as we've seen, or we wouldn't be $36 trillion in debt.
I agree. I've said this before, like, I'd much rather have just better regulation or deregulation than a strategic reserve. I don't think that's the end. But things like the Bitcoin Act, like you said, if you're going to be actively and aggressively buying Bitcoin, no matter how you chop it up, you know, whether they say it's, you know, budget neutral or whatever, ultimately it's either money that's printed, money that's taxed, or it's taking from money that could reduce those two things. So Even if you cut something out of the budget, you know, then you're still making the decision, instead of reducing taxes or reducing money printing, you're going to be buying Bitcoin. It still ultimately kind of comes out to one of those two things, which I'm not for. You know, I don't want, you know, the average taxpayer to have to feel like they're taking on the burden of buying the US Bitcoin. And I think that if people do have that general sentiment, like, it's not going to look good for Bitcoin.
Yeah. Especially since, you know, 98-99% of people don't understand Bitcoin. I saw a recent poll on Fox Business or somewhere, and they said they asked, like, you know, a bunch of people, would you consider investing in Bitcoin? Which I think is a bad way of framing it, because it obfuscates what Bitcoin really is. But it was like, I want to say it was like 86% said no and 14% said yes. But, you know, even of that 14% that said yes, only a fraction of those people understand Bitcoin. The rest of them are probably have heard good things about its returns or, you know, something like that. They're not in it for the freedom money. They would be in it for number go up to the extent that they invested. And so you're asking a large cohort of the population to somehow pay for this thing that they don't understand, that they don't even get, that their government's going to likely squat on for a long, long time. And so, yeah, I guess my point, we should probably wrap it up, but I guess my point is there are a lot of holes in the, in sort of the pro-government adopting Bitcoin argument that I could poke. And I haven't heard a whole lot of good answers besides, well, I'm going to get rich basically, if they're going to pump my bags, if the government buys a million Bitcoin and sits on it. I don't think we get to a freer, fairer world if that's the shallow victory that we achieve.
I would definitely agree that there is a possibility that it is a net negative. I think that there are some potential positives thrown in there too, which is why I come to my conclusion that I'm generally for it, but there's a lot of assumptions in there. And like I said, I'm not willing to say that there's not a chance that it's going to end up badly.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's, if it is inevitable and it's nothing I can stop, again, I can screech about it as much as I want, but I hope one net positive would be it opens up the floodgates for a lot of development free of fear that, you know, something, you know, if the government's buying it, it gives some legitimacy to the industry and to the people who, like you, who are trying to build. So hopefully we don't have choke point 3.0 and you get to just keep doing some great things. Last question for you, man. So I feel like we probably talked about a little bit of this stuff, but an unpopular opinion that you have, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners.
Gresham's law doesn't apply to Bitcoin.
What's that?
Gresham's law does not apply to Bitcoin.
Okay. You want to elaborate? You want to explain?
Sure. So first of all, people that say bad money drives out good money, it's just a useful euphemism that's been used, you know, for a long time that describes a very, very particular set of circumstances where Gresham's law does apply, but it is not universally applied. It's like saying, you know, all things that go up must come down, you know, trying to explain gravity. You know, generally speaking, that's true. And for most people, it makes the most sense, but it's not always true. Not all things that go up come down. And just like with Gresham's law, you know, not all bad money has to drive out all good money, depending on what you're talking about. So people use this as some kind of a cover because they heard somebody say it sometime, maybe on a podcast like this, and somebody said, well, I shouldn't sell any of my Bitcoin, and I should only use fiat to buy and sell things because I need to hoard as much Bitcoin as I can. And there's some decent line of thinking in there too, but my point is that is not a cause of Gresham's law. Gresham's law applies specifically when there's, you know, an imposed price for two things with different value. So if you got two quarters and one of them is solid silver and another is an inferior alloy. And the government says that the price of these two is the same, but you know that the value is different. That is where Gresham's law comes in. Okay. Mm. And it coming down, peeling that back a layer further, what we're really talking about is opportunity cost. So the opportunity cost of spending these two quarters is different. Okay. The opportunity cost of spending Bitcoin versus the opportunity cost of spending fiat with our current technology is essentially the same. And so Gresham's law doesn't apply. I'm not saying there's not good reasons to not spend Bitcoin, but that's kind of what I'm saying. Like if you want to spend Bitcoin, it's okay. I'm not advocating for you to get, you know, dump your stack and just get rid of all your Bitcoin and have more fiat dollars. That's actually the opposite of what I'm saying. I think as long as you have the mindset of, you know, you're here to produce value and save in Bitcoin, you might as well just go ahead and upgrade your form of payment to a better money. Like, don't spend any more or less necessarily, just pay people with a better money and you have the same opportunity cost. So what I do for myself is, you know, I put all my money in Bitcoin, and when I need to pay for something, I can either sell my Bitcoin for dollars and pay with fiat if I have to, or better yet, I go find somebody who can sell me something denominated in Bitcoin, and I can pay a Bitcoiner that I know, you know, has a high level of integrity for their money. So they probably also have a high level of integrity for the products that they sell and the service they provide. So that's my strongly held opinion. I've written about it. I've talked about it. I've done a lot of research on it, and I've come to the conclusive decision that Gresham's law absolutely in no way, shape, or form it can be applied to the conclusion that you cannot spend Bitcoin and you have to spend dollars.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't thought about the application of Gresham's law enough to say I agree or disagree, but I definitely do agree with you that the output of that is we should be spending Bitcoin. And the more we can make the medium exchange use case a practical reality of our lives, the better. I think that's the way we fight this peaceful revolution, is just by using it as money and, you know, buy and replace, or, you know, yeah. I mean, I know there are capital gains implications and that sort of thing. If you just spend Bitcoin, but yeah, figure it out. The more people we can get on board, and it sounds like you're working on that with Mana, who are sending and receiving Bitcoin for the productive services that they provide. I'm all on board that, man. I think we need a lot more of that. And it's honestly frustrating at times. Like the only time I feel like I get to spend Bitcoin is when I'm buying a Bitcoin related product online, a hardware wallet or, you know, a hat or something like that. And I would love to be able to, my goal this year is I want to onboard my local Go farmer who sells me raw milk onto Bitcoin and see if she'll start accepting sats for the milk that I'm buying. So I love it.
Maybe,
I think that's
maybe you can share Mana with them.
Yeah, for sure. When's it going to be operational?
It'll be this year. So it's coming soon. We don't have a final date set, but there will be announcement coming up soon. It's going to be a little bit of a surprise, so okay. You'll just have to stay tuned.
Well, hey, it's a good transition into a handoff. Tell people where they can find out more about you, follow you, Mana, you know, buy the BitKit, whatever else you want to tell them.
Yeah,
about.
You can follow my antics. It's just at Adam Semeca on X. That's pretty much the only place I live. Even a lot of the Mana stuff, you know, I post on my own personal X page. So that's where you can find me. And I really look forward to interacting with anybody that wants to. I spend a lot of time over there and really enjoy the community and just talking with everybody. So follow me over there if you want to stay tuned. I will be posting, you know, the updates to Mana in the coming weeks and months. So look forward to it.
Awesome, man. Adam, thank you so much for the time. This was fun.
Thank you, Michael. Really appreciate you having me. Hopefully we can do this again someday.
Definitely. If I'm ever out in your area, we'll get together and hang out a bit.
Awesome. We're not too far from each other, so maybe we got to do something there.
Sounds great, man. Take care. Have a good one, buddy.
See you later. Bye.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Adam. I know I sure did. Love all of the work that he is doing, putting in the proof of work to build on Bitcoin. Go check out his X page and check out everything else he's doing. Stay tuned for the updates on when Mana is going to be released.
And of course, if you're enjoying this show, do me a huge favor, subscribe to the channel, give us a like, comment on it, share it with someone who you think might be interested. We'd really appreciate that. You can also follow us on X. We're at @TheBitcoinWay_. I'm on X @TheOtherMJordan. And of course, if you need help with proper 100% Bitcoin self-custody, go to TheBitcoinWay.com/podcast. We would love for you to schedule some time to chat with a member of our team. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option, everything you need for a sovereign life. Go to TheBitcoinWay.com/podcast. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.